So as I mentioned already, we are in the 37th chapter of the text, looking at the transition, if you will, that takes place between the family as it is centric to Jacob, and now seeing what happens next. We looked last Bible study, which was Sunday morning, both at the geographical structure of the journeys of Jacob, but also at all of the events that surrounded his life, his family's life, saw some of their sorrows, saw some of the triumphs, and now things are going to shift a little bit. Chapter 37 raises the view to look deeply into the life of Joseph. Joseph becomes a figure in many senses that drives the story of God forward. I think most of us, as I survey everyone here in the auditorium, probably are relatively aware of who Joseph is and some of the circumstances around his life. What we're going to do in the course of maybe this class and next Sunday is to peel back some of those layers that will help us better understand and appreciate how God used someone like Joseph, and how God can maybe use you and I in ways that are not expected, ways that are in line with His plan and His design. But as we've noted throughout all of the work of the patriarchs, they may not have been in line with what Joseph saw as his future. If you had talked to Joseph the day before we meet him right here in the text and asked him, "Do you see yourself in Egypt?" his answer would have been an obvious no way. That doesn't make any sense to me. Because you and I live that same view. Our view is very earthly, and we don't have the vision to see beyond even tomorrow at times. So, looking firstly at the first, say, 11 verses, and we're going to read that right now together, to kind of get a handle on a little bit of what's going on. And so let's start with that. This is in Genesis chapter 37 and verses 1 through 4 to start with. And Roy, could you read that for us? Just the first four verses.
Verse 4?
Yes.
"And Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wife. And Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors. And when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him."
So again, we have a patriarchal family and relationship. As we get to walk into it, is it good or bad? We can simplify it down. It's bad. And I think early on, we can identify three causes for the brokenness of their relationship. Some of them are really obvious to us. We probably already know what it is. And some of them might require us to think a little bit in the bigger picture. Some things that also catch together. In noting what takes place in the middle section of this text, Joseph is bringing an evil report about the behavior of his brothers back to his father. There's a cultural struggle with that, because at least, especially in young boy culture, because young boy culture learns something that has also moved into adult culture later. Nobody loves a snitch. And as a little brother, in my experiences, I can speak forcefully on the experiential side. When little brother goes to mom and dad and says what big brothers and cousins are doing, and they're not up to good, they're up to no good, nobody wins. Because even if little brother was innocent, he's going to pay either from mom and dad's account or from his brother's account. And so you're going to pay one way or the other. So we catch that. But here's something different. The cultural side of it, oh, nobody loves a snitch. Were his brothers engaged in evil?
Yes.
Yes, they were. And was he going to the appropriate source of resolution? We could say authority. Was he going to the appropriate source? Yeah. Did it make for a good relationship with his brothers? Whose fault was that?
His brothers.
You know, but on the other end, you think about this. I got to stand there for a second. Is that a hand of a question? Or are you taking responsibility for his brother's behavior? You go to it, though. Hey, look, they were evil. He's reporting evil to the right source. Could there have been a better way? Possibly. Do we have the whole picture? Nope. All we know is that evil was engaged in. He's reporting it back to his brothers, and he's going to learn some lessons and maybe pay a price. Tim, real quick.
I mean, it's obviously already a broken relationship between he and his brothers. Because realistically, the best way, at least what we taught our children, the first step is to go to that person directly.
Yeah.
And the Bible doesn't record that he did that. And maybe he did, and this was the second attempt, to resolve it through the next direction, kind of like Jesus describes in Matthew 18.
Right, and tying it together, you have the broad teaching of both the Old and the New Testament that the goal is not to prove someone wrong, but to draw them back to God. And you may do that by going to them and telling them about their sin and begging them back and matching Jesus' teaching and matching some of the instruction of the rest of the New Testament. You may also extend that and bring another witness with you and follow that Old and New Testament principle of on the basis of two or three witnesses as every fact can be confirmed. And then if that doesn't go, and you think about the text of Matthew, you might bring it to the church. In this case, we're before the law and we're before the new law in Christ. And so we're going to have to take our steps into where it is. And it's already at that point where he's going back to his father. Furthermore, there's a couple other factors, and we also see those as well. Another factor that's taking place, aside from his willingness to expose the sin and wickedness of his brothers, is the coat of many colors. The special possession, this prized thing. Well, he gets that. What about us? There's a sense of envy that can be connected there as well. And there's something we've seen a lot with the patriarchs. Who is the favored son?
Joseph.
There's no getting around the impact of that relationship shift. Now, here's some things to think about it. Joseph's disposition seems to be inclined towards peace and moral behavior because he's exposing wickedness. Jacob has to deal with the immoral behavior of his brothers at times and the consequences of their lack of a peaceful plan for resolution. So there's a kinship, it seems, between Joseph and Jacob on that spiritual plane where his brothers seem to be more like Laban and Esau, profane men. And we're going to see more of that come to pass. And so there's a divide. And I want us to catch one more thing. The Bible, the Old Testament, and the New Testament are full of themes. And themes are not so much about theological positions or doctrinal positions, but it's a sense of a picture that comes up often. The picture might be light or the I am statements of Christ. Well, in the patriarchal families, it's a picture of schism with reconciliation. Two can't get along. Reconciliation is offered, but then two can't get along. You think about it from Genesis, the beginning of Genesis, chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, all the way through the Old Testament. They can't walk together, but God keeps trying to bring them together. And so these families typify that pattern, which also matches the relationship that you and I have with God. Where we want to be with God, but our sin severs it, and then God tries to bring us back. And so that picture is throughout all of these things. So in this setting, you've got the exposure of wickedness, you've got the favored son status, and the favored gift. And those three factors together certainly drive the last nail in the coffin of a good relationship. That moves us forward about verse 5 in the text. And let's go ahead and look at that right now. Let's see. trying to spread out my reading patterns. I had noticed I'd been down this aisle too much, and so if you're on the wing, Norris, he looked up. Got him. Norris, could you read verses 5 through 11 for us?
And Joseph dreamed a dream and told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. So he said to them, please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were dying sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaves arose and also stood upright, and indeed your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaves. And his brother said to him, shall you indeed reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his word. Then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, look, I have dreamed another dream. And this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me. So he told it to his father and his brother. And his father rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brother indeed come to bow down to the earth before you? And his brother envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind.
Interesting fact in this, how accurate are the interpretations of the application of this dream? Spot on. Now you think about that. A lot of times when God's prophetic plans are being laid out, how quickly do the people of God catch on? And they're kind of obtuse like you and I. We're stubborn. Like, oh, that's not me. Can't be me. They caught it. But you see a shift in response. The brothers envy it. Well, why are we bowing down to him? The father? I didn't think about that. Keeps it in mind. He ponders it. Is there any other biblical event where a parent found out some special things about their child and kept it in their heart?
Mary.
Yeah. So there's a couple of biblical instances where you see this quick cap. This is important. I gotta hold on to this. They might not understand all the implications. Certainly they don't understand the big picture plan for Joseph. Because they would have, you know, well, we're going to bow down to him. But in order for that to happen, we have to sell him into slavery. Well, we're not going to sell him into slavery. It solves the problem. You know, they would have stopped it at the get-go. But here, you see that shift of response, though, that dad, he keeps it. Brothers, they hate it. That tells us more about their character. It tells us a little bit more about where they're coming from. But also, Israel / Jacob, he's got a closer connection to God, too. He's heard some of God's plans in the sense of, go do, I'll take care of you. And then he's seen the fruit of that trust in a different way, having that closer relationship. And so that then leads to this third level of challenge for the brothers, which is, he's going to rule over us. Well, that's not right. I mean, that's in their mind, because Reuben should have been the one being bowed down to. And who's the one in charge and pushing things around and getting his way at this point when the 10, you know, are over, you know, putting that aside? There's a whole mindset that shifts around. You know, Reuben's got this angry attitude. Judah's got this perspective that he's the man. You know, by the way, Benjamin, he's a little baby at this point. You know, he's about 10 years younger in perspective. And so he would not have even been party to these things. It also helps understand why Benjamin was so important to Joseph when the reconciliation takes place, because he doesn't even know him in that sense. Other background we just studied, remember to understand these behaviors, his son's behavior with Shechem and all of that awfulness, Reuben's profanity with his decision to take one of his father's wives, Bilhah, Rachel's handmaid, and have relations with her in chapter 35, verse 22. And even beyond that, after he's been exposed, he's exposed his brother's wickedness to his father, they continue to engage in this wicked behavior. And catch this, we didn't pull it out before, but even in verse 4 it said, they were not able to even work with him or speak to him peaceably. That terminology that's used in the King James and the American Standard would be thought of in this way. They weren't even able to say, hey, how you doing? Hello, it's good to see you. That's a tell in a relationship. When you don't care about the well-being of the person you're talking to, even in the formalities, when you shift from, okay, let's get out of work, and my work is I don't like you and you don't like me, then your relationship has just degraded to that point. And so that's where they were. They had kind of degraded to that level. So, with that pinpoint of idea, they don't get along. He's got more dreams for them. They respond to that in what way? What's their plan? They got a plan. Yeah, they're going to initially, let's get rid of them. Get them off the picture. Because then our snitch is gone. Because if you look at it from their perspective, their hearts are already profaned. He's the one that's a troubler of Israel, as they see it, because he's telling them, don't do it. And he's telling on them, you did it. And so their solution, well, let's bring it down. So, but in the end, he sold into slavery. That's a shift. It's a shift that is in line with the plans and hand of God, but it is engaged in by the hands and heart of the men involved. And this looking at verses about 12 through 30, the end of the chapter, but 12 through 17 first. It seems, as we read through it, that Jacob and Joseph don't really understand the risk involved. Because you think about this, if he really understood the character of his brothers, would he be out there by himself? And would his dad have sent him out there? No, they don't really understand. And I think that also helps us understand the relationship between you and I as we follow God and the world around us. We keep looking at the world and expecting it to behave like we do. Why do we behave the way we do, by the way? Is it because we just know what the right thing is? We were born that way? We were taught to walk differently than the world. With that teaching means that we respond differently to the same event. Our hearts go to compassion, where their heart may go to, I hate you. And we don't understand when they respond differently than us, because our hearts have diverged. Well, there's a big divergence here. You see a lot of that in this dynamic where people were even in the same household, lived through the same events, respond entirely different to the same things. And so that kind of helps us understand a little bit about, because people we might be interacting with the world, they might be our family in the flesh, they might be our co-workers who we work with day in and day out. They may be those who had once tasted of the righteousness of God and have tossed it to the side. And so we see that kind of play itself out. And this is probably a section of the text that we've read a lot. You know, we've probably seen this passage unfold. But the pain of it doesn't go away. Because there's one painful section toward the end of it that I want us to really kind of, you know, catch about it. Here he is. He goes out there with the instruction of a plan. I'm going to go and do this responsible thing. I'm going to tell about that. We've got to go do this. And then there he is in the pit. Have you ever been like, you can think about it. Have you ever been picked on, put down, shamed by someone who is in power, stepped on? You can kind of sympathize with Joseph here when he's looking up from the pit. Because his accusers are standing over him. And they've tossed him in there. And they forced him in there. How heartbreaking is that? Yeah, that's one of these instances in the Bible where if we pause for a moment and step into the emotional shoes of God's people, that's the believer in any century. Revelation reminds us that one of the things that cries out for justice and judgment is the blood of the prophets and the blood of the righteous. Those souls cry out for justice. And this is a moment where you can see, in essence, the angry mob with its pitchforks, which are his brothers, pushing down on him. You know, you talk about how low could you feel? Pretty low right there, right? Where's his hope? Is he going to crawl out and overpower all 10 of them? He's the little brother. That fact has already probably been proven to him that he can't do that, because that's what big brothers do to little brothers. To make sure that they know that they're not the big brothers yet. Sometimes the tables turn. But here it is, that moment. Something about Joseph is different, though. Because as we follow his life forward and think about this, where does he end up? He ends up in prison and then rises to the top. He's a slave up and then in prison. He's in prison, he's free, imprisoned again, and he rises higher. How does he bounce like that? Yeah, he humbles himself in the sight of God and trusts in God's plan. You want to learn how to bounce in life? Because there's no doubt that you will be in the pit. I say that from the scriptural standpoint that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. That's you and I. There's no doubt you'll be in the pit. There's no doubt that maybe at times you were pushing someone else in the pit. And yet God allows us to bounce. And that bounce often exceeds the fall. Because he's going to glorify us. He's going to bring us back to him. And there's a great picture that takes place in the emotional transition of this event, which is aside from all the details and aside from who's there. There's also some action that's engaged in by Judah. What does Judah try to do?
He tries to deliver his brother.
He tries to Johnny come lately.
You talk about Reuben?
Well, Reuben and Judah are both trying to do some things in the outcome. Judah said to his brethren, "What profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood?" And so their initial attempt, we'll just kill him. New plan. We'll sell him. And then the picture expands. That Judah's heart is a little bit different than his brother's, trying to see if he can get some extra cash involved. But Reuben, that is, comes back around. And Reuben, in contrast, I had Reuben and Judah juxtaposed in my head there for a minute. Let's straighten that out. Reuben comes back, and they're going to see this falling out. Let's go ahead and read 25 to 32 so I can get straight and we can all get straight. Tim, would you read that for us? Chapter 37, verse 25 to 32.
And they sat down to eat. And looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way down to carry it to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Then Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him up out of the pit, sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes and returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is gone, and where shall I go?" Then they took Joseph's robe and slaughtered a goat and dipped the robe in the blood. And they sent the robe of many colors and brought it to their father and said, "This we have found. Please identify whether it's your son's robe or not."
Yeah, so this comes on the heels of the conversation in verses 18 to 24, where Reuben states, Reuben, by the way, is the one who had engaged in fornication with his father's wife. That's another connection to the New Testament, by the way, the kind of immorality that should never even be named among them. Says, "Shed no blood, cast him into the pit that is in this wilderness, but lay no hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hand to restore him to his father." That was Reuben's plan, oddly coming from this sense of morality. Judah comes up and says, "No, we're gonna sell him, we're gonna follow through with this plan," and then they engage in a level of deception equivalent to Laban's action. They just hide it with the blood of sorrow, which leads to another awful place. Because you think about this, and you think about when that message comes home. When Joseph learns, for all that he knows, or Jacob that is learns, for all that he knows, that Joseph's gone. From the standpoint of understanding, that's a hard pill to swallow. You know, understanding God's plan in that. Because God needs Joseph somewhere else, and Jacob has to go through the pit of that time believing that his son, who was on the same page in many ways, his favorite son obviously, is gone. That's another level of heartbreak that does catch itself in the New Testament a little bit. You talk about the sacrifice of a father and a sacrifice of a son to redeem maybe an unworthy people. Because if you ask yourself, are Joseph's brothers worth saving? Well, the answer better be yeah. But by man's standard, would you go through that level of effort? No. Well, isn't there some better work we could be doing? Isn't there someone more worthy, more needy? That's the earthly perspective. God's standard was, yeah, they were. And you look at them, like, well, that's not who I would pick to save. Why are we doing this, God? God's picture is different than ours. He sees things far better than we do. And he knows something that we forget. He made you and I, and he made them too. And he wants them back just as much as he wants us back. And that's a hard thing to swallow, because the them here we see in the brothers, well, we already don't like them. How many times have we had dinner with that family, though? None. Do we want to? Not really. But we're only seeing them on their worst day. They're loved by their family. They love their family in many ways. We can see that. We can see that dedication and commitment. And we don't get to see their best days. We get to see one really great day for them. We get to see the day of reconciliation. Even with fear, they go in with humbleness. And so we do get to see at least one good day for them. And it came about because of the sacrifice of the brother they hated. It's just a great picture that's coming in there. But Jacob tears off his garments in chapter 37 and verse 33 and 34. He puts on sackcloth. He laments and mourns for his son for many days. And his sons and his daughters rise up to comfort him. You think about all those boys. That's a pretty hollow comforter. But pause for a moment again and walk in their steps. Have you been that person before? Where you've offered a hollow comfort to someone? You know, you didn't really mean it, but you did it anyway. Oh, because it's the right thing to do. It's a good thing to catch in yourself and say, wait a minute, no. If I see it's wrong for them to do it, it's wrong for me to do it. The solution isn't to not offer comfort, by the way. And if the solution is to learn to comfort genuinely and to learn to empathize and sympathize with those who are hurting and give them genuine comfort. There's no easy way out. You know, there's no easy solution. Well, this means I don't have to offer comfort because I can't do it for real. No, it means you give it for real. In this chapter, by the way, there are probably three great lessons to learn for us as we kind of move towards chapter 39. Maybe we'll get there tonight, I'm not sure. First thing they catch, both Joseph and Jacob, and we kind of identified this already, underestimated the wicked character of the brothers. The thing for you and I, never underestimate nor be deceived by the wickedness of evil men. Don't be surprised when sinful actions are evil in their outcome, as if, oh, how did that happen? Evil men devise evil plans. Their evil actions at times will impact you and I. They may be small, an unkind word. They may be great, a total damage to every aspect of who you are and every part of your life. But that's not a surprise, because sin has that impact and that stain. And that stain was on us too. It doesn't mean that it doesn't hurt anymore. It just means now we know. Tim?
There's such a strong tension holding those up, those principles of not being naive and yet trying to think the best, trying to look for a way of reconciliation, even when we're planning for trying to mitigate the failure, you know, because reconciliation is not necessarily desired.
Yeah. You know, when you're thinking about it in this sense, maybe this is a way that I can process it for right now. You know, your children may at one point have to get a shot for something. Everybody knows that shot's going to hurt, right? But we tell our kids it's going to be okay. Because we believe that through the pain, in the end, it will be okay. But does that stop the hurt? No. In fact, it kind of isolates it and magnifies it. As the event comes, you're hurting with them. When it's in the context of a person and it's not about a needle anymore, and they're coming in at you, you know it's going to hurt. But you're looking to make it okay. And you know that the only way for it to be okay is to maybe go through some pain. The pain might be your own sins being exposed by the spear of the gospel. The pain might be the sin of someone else being exposed and watching that go through. That's not pleasant at all. But in either case, the pain has the chance to bring forth victory. And as you might have said to the little kid, it's going to be okay. Give it some time. This will work for your best. And so really powerfully, that's that tension coming into play, because you know, and yet you still have to look beyond it. That's how I process that picture and see that picture, Tim.
And that's worthwhile.
Yeah.
And that's how God has given glory, and that's what we're called to do, rather than avoiding or just looking out for ourselves.
Right. Because most folks have a tendency to try to avoid pain. I don't like that. Some pain has a process, like working out, you avoid the pain, you don't get stronger. But spiritually, we have a same process, but rather than thinking we'll get stronger, we avoid the pain because we just don't want to hurt anymore. That's not going to be helpful, and that wasn't helpful here. And it's certainly not helpful when we're dealing with sinful matters. Like if you think about trying to pull someone out of the fire, well, you're going to get a little dirty in that process because you're going to have to actually endure. Maybe not, that's why you say take heed to yourself as you engage in that process. Second thing to catch is a big lesson. With general consistency, envy leads to hatred. Those are behaviors that go from one to another. Solomon writes in 27 and 4 of the text of Proverbs, "Wrath is cruel. And anger is outrageous, but who is able to stand before envy?" The New Testament kind of matches that same picture. That's where it goes. Especially in the sense where envy is not satisfied. Because envy is, in this context, they have it, I want it. But if envy isn't satisfied, if they can't get their vengeance, or they can't get the thing, or the status, well, then they hate them. They loathe them. They can't be around them. Oh, I can't be around you. Did you see how our father treated Joseph again? I can't be around that anymore. Because it's not right. That's the attitude of the brothers in the nutshell. It's gone from envy to now they want to kill him. Because, by the way, just to catch it in the text of Galatians and the works of the flesh and in some of the teaching of Jesus, he talks about the same way about an anger that's equivalent to murder. There's being angry at sin, and God commends that level of emotional response to rebellion to God. But there's also the kind of anger that breeds to the next phase. And anger that rises to a terminology that's in the Hebrew, raka, and this kind of level of despisal that says, I wish you were dead. You see, you think about that meanness, I wish you were dead. Do we want that? No. But does the heart of the world often get there? Well, yeah. It can. And what do you think drives a person to actually kill someone? And sometimes it's that. It's that very thing, that level of anger, angry behavior unresolved. Tim?
That's what God was trying to warn Cain about with his anger towards, again, the jealousy, the status, wanting that, And unfortunately, he didn't listen to the warning and allow that to master him.
Yeah. And it's right now mastering these brothers. Their envy, which has led to hatred, is driving their choices, even when they try to back off from the pedal and say, well, you can't do that. It still flows forth in everything that they do. A third big truth to catch from the text is really simple. Simply in the role of a patriarch does not mean that they were the moral examples of excellence. I think we've caught that a lot. But I think it's powerful to remember that that's part of the bigger picture of God. The sons of Jacob murdered, robbed, and killed the Hivite people before this. Reuben's sin in the profane way in which he engaged in sexual relations would later be illustrated as being so wildly out of God's plans that you wouldn't even talk about it taking place. And yet, it occurred in the church at Corinth that a man had his father's wife. It also reveals the level at this point in their development of their jealousy and hatred. Judah's sin in chapter 38, which we looked at Sunday, in marrying a Hivite woman and then committing fornication after she died. And later in the text, we haven't gotten there yet, but in Genesis 46, we learn that Simeon had married a Canaanite or Canaanitish woman as well. So their choices and their actions are littered with individual rebellion, but we only get to see portions of their lives. Another factor to consider: our redemption is not found in their faithfulness. That's a powerful truth in the text, that their faithfulness doesn't bring about our redemption. And we also learn in the Old Testament, this is a thing that comes through, the soul that sins shall die, right? That's a truth that comes forth from the Old Testament. So they were accountable for their sins, but I'm accountable for mine. Well, there is part of their family line that is involved with my redemption. And this family, with all of its messy bits and pieces and parts and places and people and things, does rise over time to continually, in many ways, be better and then be the best platform for the redemption of God. Even when Christ comes, is that a great Israel that he comes into? No. But by whose standard? Think about it again. And I would agree with you that it's not a great Israel. It's a very needy Israel. They need something. They're looking for something. They're missing something. They don't have their kingdom anymore as they see it. They are a subjugated people. And this is part of the idea of this text moving forward. We're not going to get into chapter 39. I think we've got, according to the bell structure, I've got about 4 minutes. So 39 is not going to happen. But they need something. And this Israel here becomes a foundation for what they need. They don't have their kingdom in the first century when Christ comes. They are a subjugated people. They're under the authority of the Romans. They've already gone through a couple of attempted rebellions by that time. And yet these people are the foundation for the arrival of the Christ. Perfect for that role. And in many cases, the hearts of these people are some of the best hearts around. Because God's prophet comes in John. And where was John doing his preaching?
In the wilderness.
Yeah. Does that seem like you're going to find a lot of people there? Why do we go to the woods today? I know I go to the woods. Because there's not people there. There's no cell service there. You're kind of isolated there. That's where John was. So anyone who went to hear John chose to go seek that. So those are the kind of people that created the groundswell to hear this great message. And John wasn't like any of them. How did he dress? Did he dress like a temple priest? No. Opposite. He dressed a lot like some of the pictures of their Old Testament prophets were, the big prophets, like Elijah did. You know, so, well, wait a minute. I've heard about this John guy. I'm going. And that wasn't just like, I'll go to the movies tonight to watch the new show that's coming out. It's, Let's go on a journey. Let's get everyone together. That's a good understanding to catch what we're seeing in these patriarchal families, because they're not the icons of superheroism, all the perfect people. They're imperfect people, and their sins are laid bare for us, and their bad decisions are laid bare for us. And yet God still is able to work his plan through all of that. He's able to continue through with a very specific plan. It's an evidence of God's capacity to build out his plan in opposition to ours. It's talking about his omnipotence, his great power. It's talking about his omnipotence, that great power, but his omniscience, his ability to understand and see. And his ability to also emote, because he keeps through it with his emotions. He loves us. He loves them. He rescues them when they're unworthy. We'll be looking at chapter 39, by the way, next class, as I mentioned a couple of times, because we already looked at 38 Sunday. Chapter 39 moves us into the next phase of Joseph's life. So I want you to read through 39 this week, but read through with an eye to see how this continued story of God goes through. Not just about the interpersonal relationships between Joseph, Potiphar's wife, some of those failed choices, but how Joseph keeps pressing forward and God's plan keeps going forward. How the schism that exists is going to be drawn back together. Because you can see hints of it here. You see hints of it in his character, hints of it in God's plan for him, his service that continues to rise up. That's it for tonight. And so next class, Sunday morning, we'll be stepping into chapter 39. Thanks, everybody.